I'm Joe. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. I have a sport coat on. Okay. You might think I'm from Los Angeles, but I was born in a little town in Michigan, so and I don't wear ties. I tried that once in AA, and I learned the difference between humiliation and humility. I was at one of these things, and I was pretty new, and I was told to wear a tie, and I was told to go in the bathroom and get on my knees and say a prayer. And I went in the bathroom, and I got on my knees, and I said a prayer, and I got up, and my tie had been resting in the toilet. And my sponsor told me, when I got down on my knees, it was humility, and when I got up, it was humiliation. And I've had an aversion to ties ever since. And it's really good to be here. I want to thank the committee for inviting me. It's an honor and a privilege, especially after my reputation in Alcoholics Anonymous before. They mentioned getting invited back somewhere where you'd been drunk. For me, it's a miracle to get invited back somewhere where I've been sober. I want to thank my host, Dave. Dave doesn't miss a thing. He's the kind of guy you want on a committee. He's a real alcoholic with Al-Anon tendencies. We've talked more than my sponsor and I have talked in the last few months. And he doesn't miss a thing. That's good. That's good. What else did I want to get off my mind? Louisiana hospitality. Big part of my disease is forgetting. And I forget good stuff, too. Now, I can't remember with enough force my last drunk to keep me sober today. And sometimes I forget the love that's kept me here. You all are... I'm glad the lights are on because I wouldn't want to stand in this room without being able to see your eyes. Got to be careful in Louisiana. But I like seeing your eyes. And I was amazed I still have some friends here. I know Bobby and Danny. They love me. And in spite of myself. I have some other friends here too. I also wanted to mention the hospitality menu on the back of your program. I was glad to see they included the four basic food groups. Jambalaya, gumbo, donuts, and hamburgers. That's a hell of a menu. Yeah. California, they're all fussy and stuff. Can't just order off the menu. It's got to be like changed about 10 times. I live in a crazy place, Los Angeles. So. Never fit in. I don't fit in there, but that's all right. I never fit in anywhere, except with you people. People that believe in all three parts of this program. I'm a real alcoholic. I'm a type 4. They're described in the chapter to the wives, one of the lost chapters of the big book. And I hadn't read it for a while. And they describe four kinds of alcoholics. I'm not into separation and division anymore, but I need to find myself. And I need to find myself in the eyes of real alcoholics and what they need to do. And it describes type 1 may or may not even be alcoholic. Type 2 has begun to get in a little trouble. Type 3 is in a little more trouble. And type 4 is just out of options. And the interesting thing, if you're new, type 4 has a better chance for our program than the other three types. Now, why is that? Because that's not logical. You would think, you know, if they haven't lost it all, you know, they'd have a better chance. Better motivated, probably got a little power. No. Type 4s have a better chance because they got no other alternatives. They got maybe two, if they're lucky. If you're lucky, you got two alternatives. Die an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis. But the messed up thing about that is we're all going to die an alcoholic death. And we're either going to die with it or from it. We're either going to die with it at peace or from it not at peace. And you do not have to drink again to die from alcoholism. in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I believe alcoholism is what you're left with after the alcohol is out of your system. And the funny thing is, in my experience, it was in full bloom before I ever took a drink. I'm not a what it was like kind of speaker. I remember my first Colorado, I got sober in Denver, Colorado, and I was given this gift August 17th, 1982, and for that date I am very grateful, and it's not a noun anymore that you just go home and feel. It's an action you express, just like love. But I remember my first Colorado State Convention, and I'm sitting with one of my heroes, and she ran the Denver Central office for 35 years, and she's still alive, and I think she's about 40, 45 years sober. Lynn B. from Denver, and we're sitting there, and it was one of these speakers that says, I'm not going to tell you much about my drunk log, and you're like, oh boy, here we go, right? But, and it's on 45, 50, 55 minutes, and he's still drunk, and she leaned over to me, and she said, I think I want him to get sober more than his own family did, right? And it's great when your heroes blow their cover, right? I was like, wow, she actually said that, right? And they free you up to be human. It's like when you find out your sponsor's human. Oh, that's a great thing. That's a great thing. Because you can be human too. I was born in Battle Creek, Michigan. Not much of a town. Halfway between Detroit and Chicago. That's about what I was like. I was somewhere halfway between Detroit and Chicago. In a family where there was abundance, opportunity, wealth, no alcoholism. My dad was a classic hard drinker. My dad was 60 years old when I was born, and my mom was 30. And I never admired that like I should have, like I do now. It's a hell of a thing. In therapy, for many, many years, as I'll tell you a little bit about, in therapy, his age when I was born caused me a tremendous amount of pain. It was always the cutting-edge issue of my life. That, you know, by the time I was 10, he was 70 and didn't play baseball, and man, since I woke up a little bit here, it doesn't cause me a lot of pain. It gives me a tremendous amount of hope for the next 9 years of my life. For you new people, because I would like to be doing what he was doing when I'm 60 years old, right? Bobby reminded me, I got to explain myself a little better now that I've grown up a little bit. And, you know, I was in a family where it was hard to find an excuse to be different. Some of you came here with excuses. We all got to have our excuses when we're new. You hear a lot about the yets, but I wonder how many of you remember the if-onlys. If only Daddy hadn't been 60 when I was born. If only they hadn't sent me to that school. If only I hadn't hung out with those guys. And you got your little if-only story. I wouldn't have turned out the way I did. And then you're sitting in a meeting in your first 90 days or so, and somebody tells your little if-only story, and they turned out just as sick as you did. And you realize there ain't no if-onlys with alcoholism. But I had to find some excuses to feel the way I felt. It certainly wasn't going to take any responsibility, at least before I found a solution, you know. And I was just lonely, out of place, quiet, withdrawn, you know. First time I read the doctor's opinion, and it said a part of our disease separates us and differentiates us like a distinct entity. I thought, my God, that fits the daydreams I had in my parents' backyard before I ever took a drink. You know what my daydreams were before I ever took a drink? I can remember. I'm talking 9, 10, 11 years old. I'd sit in their backyard and dream a little spaceship was going to land. And a little green man was going to get out. And he was going to say, son, you weren't born here. We brought you here as a teeny baby. We wanted to see if you could fit in. and you failed the test, and we're taking you home, right? Didn't happen. Didn't happen. But I found something around age 12 in the middle of this family. It was Chivas Regal from my dad's liquor cabinet. I like to say I started at the bottom and slowly worked my way down, right? To this day, well, not to this day, but to the day of my last drink, Chivas Regal was one of those drinks, just to smell it, my whole body would just go, right? But something happened that night, even though I didn't like the taste, didn't like puking. And you listen to a real alcoholic, and they're not going to, not the first time they drank, maybe not, but you're going to find a time when it worked, when it did the magic that all you alcoholics know. And you listen to a new person when they get in touch with when that happened, and it happened for me that night. They're not going to just describe something that was fun or that was, you know, going to feel good. They're going to describe a spiritual awakening. They're going to describe feeling connected to something within themselves they never felt connected to. And there was some real power in that. If you're new and you think you're having a problem coming to believe in a power greater than yourself or turning your will and your life over to a power greater than yourself, look at some of the higher powers you've had. Look at some of the things you've turned your will and, I should say, people you've turned your will and your life over to the care of. I was told when I was new, you can come to believe in God the same way you came to believe in booze. So how did I come to believe in booze? I never came to believe in booze sitting across the street from a liquor store. I never came to believe in booze reading a book about what it would be like to get drunk. That's the insanity of big book studies. Studying the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is an absolute waste of time, unless it gets you excited about following the instructions in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like a set of swing set instructions. Imagine your son's had a dream for a swing set for 7 years, and you finally go, you get the swing set, you say, it'll be a little while. Mom and I are going to have to sit in the living room for 6 months and read the instructions, but we'll get back to you as soon as we're done reading them. No, you got to go out in the yard, you got to put part A to part B to part C to part D, you got a swing set. That's what the big book does, except it ain't about a swing set, it's about a spiritual awakening as the result of this program of action. So I never came to believe in booze sitting across the street or hearing about it from friends. I had to make a decision, take some action, get some results, and then I had faith. Same thing here. You see it work in others. You make a decision at step 3. You take some action in 4 through 9. You get some results outlined in our book. Then you have faith. And I got to tell you, I came to believe in God the same way I came to believe in booze. And I believed in booze. I put it before anyone, anything that ever came between me and it. I loved my mother. I loved my father. I swore to my mother I wouldn't drink the day of my dad's funeral. When I was in the locked ward of the same hospital that he died in. And I meant that. I meant that with all my heart. That's the baffling feature of alcoholism to someone who doesn't have it. And you have a brother who says, why don't you just make up, it's just a phase you're going through. I had an 18-year phase with alcohol, right? Because I have alcoholism under there. Because every description of untreated alcoholism in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous fits me before I ever took a drink. And I remember at a young age, I think it was one of the times my father had a heart attack, and I was about 9 or 10 years old, and I could hear it in the other room, and I don't have a solution. And I hear him suffering and yelling, the ambulance coming, and I shut down because I couldn't go into that place, that place where we find God. I couldn't go in there, and I made a decision never to go in there again. And at age 12, I found a solution. I found a solution. And isn't it funny? Isn't it ironic that alcohol treats alcoholism? And it did. And it did. And I came alive. And isn't it funny when my family used to say to me before I drank, you have so much potential. Remember that one? You have so much potential. And you're laying there in bed and you're wondering, well, where is it? Where is it? And isn't it funny? My question when they said I had potential was, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? And finally, when I found a solution, when I found my potential, when I found some power, their statement became, "What's wrong with you?" When I finally found a solution. That's messed up. I was on fire. I came alive. They didn't know what to do with me. I had some power in my life. I could walk across the gym and ask that little girl to dance. I could go out with the tough guys. I could say whatever I wanted to say. I could yell at my dad. A year earlier, I couldn't say nothing. And they started asking, "What's wrong with you?" And I wanted to say, "Nothing now. Ain't nothing wrong with me." You should have known what it was like inside of here before I found this stuff in my daddy's liquor cabinet. So they didn't know what to do. I was 13 years old in Battle Creek, Michigan. Had never really been anywhere, maybe Chicago on the train or something. And they sent me away to a private school in Massachusetts. And they didn't know it was one of the number one drug schools in the country. And I went from Boone's Farm Apple Wine in Battle Creek, Michigan, to LSD-25 from the chemistry teacher at the school I went to who worked for Timothy Leary and Ram Dass at Harvard University in a matter of 3 months. That's a psychic change. That was a big change in consciousness. Found out later I'm not a real addict, but that's not part of this story. Not everybody that uses drugs is an addict. And not everybody that drinks alcohol is alcoholic. And thank God I met some people several years later that knew the difference between alcoholism and drug addiction. Because I'll tell you this, there's a really simple question. We used to go into all this other stuff and all that complicated stuff. It's really simple. Everyone in this room that has some time in this program that's alcoholic knows alkies that could take or leave drugs. And every addict in this room, the real addicts, know alcoholics that could take or leave drugs or alcohol, vice versa. Some people are both. But I met somebody who gave me the grace and the dignity to find my own truth because he had been given the same grace and the same dignity in this program. I had bouts with drugs. I ended up in the Michigan State Penitentiary when I was 19. And from a family like that, it was a little shocking. I loved it. I loved it. I got sent to a minimum security camp with a lake and we could fish and I had my boombox, drank and used every day in the penitentiary from during my formative years, from 19 to 21. Right? It was like summer camp with brothers, right? I had a ball, got to tell you. The heat was off. It was my third felony. Daddy bought me out of the first two. Third one, the judge said, "Daddy's dead, he ain't getting you out of this one." And they sent me to the penitentiary because I mistakenly cashed $55,000 worth of checks in 5 days. And they weren't mine for some reason. They were. But they lowered the charge to uttering and publishing, and I liked that because I could tell people I was a writer. Right? Sounds a little more romantic than forgery. I was a publisher, right? Got out when I was 21 and kept doing what I was doing with a firm resolution not to do it again for 9 more years. Walked away from drugs. That's where I lose it really. I woke up one day and I said, "I hate where heroin takes me. Gets me in trouble." Never did it again the rest of my life. A real addict looks at me and his eyes gloss over. He doesn't understand that because he couldn't make up his mind about that stuff. Had a little bout with cocaine in Key West, Florida. Woke up one day. I didn't say I hate where it takes me because it didn't take me anywhere. You can't go very far on that kind of stuff. But I said I hate the way it makes me feel. Never did it again the rest of my life. I'm a real alcoholic who was a hard drug user. Given a sufficiently strong reason, I walked away from every drug I ever did, and I found that truth in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's as applicable to addicts as it is to alcoholics. And some find out they're both. I think if you're both, you got a much better chance at doing the work in the big book. There ain't no out. You're screwed either way. Right? But my sponsor made sure I didn't have any reservation that I was powerless over where drugs take me. I didn't have the illusion little marijuana wasn't going to lead to my death. But the funny thing is, drugs take me to my drug of no choice, but in treatment they were trying to tell me it was my drug of choice. That's a dangerous thing to tell an alcoholic in treatment, that alcohol is your drug of choice. My drug of choice was yours, and you were either going to give me some or you weren't, and you had a choice. But my drug of choice, I had, my favorite drug is alcohol, and I had no choice. Yeah. You got to be careful when you're, when, you just got to be careful nowadays if your life's on the line. I told my sponsor I committed the same insane act for the third time in my 22 years of sobriety, and I went and tried to work in that field again this not too long ago, a couple years ago. He said, well, you're getting a lot better. It only took you 5 months to learn how insane you are. But here's a typical story. Might as well mention it. Woman in long-term treatment in Texas with my friend Mark Houston. 28 times in treatment, 49 years old, chronic relapser, can't stop drinking. I spent some time with her. It's not what I did. She looked in that book. She found her truth. She got a first step for the first time in all these years after all these treatment centers. And in staff, they said, she's doing so good. She's finally got a first step. So now let's give her her relapse prevention plan. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but to me, that is alcoholic insanity. Funny thing is, that's alcoholic insanity suffered by a non-alcoholic who doesn't understand. Because if I can prevent my next relapse, how in the world can I be powerless over alcohol? So maybe now I should tell you a little bit about what I'm not. I'm not an alcoholic with a choice today. Because you got to figure in 8,000, how many ever many days it's been, I would have made the wrong choice at least once with my track record. In a fit spiritual condition, there's about as much choice to drink as there was to not drink when I got here. And that's a promise in my big book. That's promise that I've experienced. Not just believe, that I've experienced, that you'll be placed in a position of neutrality. The problem will be removed. You haven't even really sworn off, but there's no choice. If you look at every story in that big book that describes the insanity of the first drink, every one of them suffered from the delusion that somehow they had a choice that day. So I'm not an alcoholic that came here with a choice. And I'm not an alcoholic that has stayed here by making the right choice every day. I'm not an alcoholic that can smash his ego. I'm not an alcoholic that can work on his character defects. So for the last 22 years, I have sought out people that have the same disease. And that's not easy sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous nowadays. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous to tell you what I've experienced that doesn't always sound good. I got free of being popular, being a speaker 7 years ago because I got a little too popular in my own mind, right? It's like, you know, my sponsor told me when I started speaking because they put me into it early. And I'm grateful for that. And I'm grateful for the people I got to meet everywhere I went with Don. My first 5 years in Denver, I found out if I want more than an hour a week with my sponsor, I go with him to a conference, and I got to meet the giants in AA. One of my first speakers was Franklin Williams, Norm Alfie, trustees from the General Service Board. Some of them aren't even alcoholic, and they love AA. I learned about commitment. Met people everywhere I went, Joe and Charlie. Yeah. But I also got to tell you, I'm not an alcoholic with a twofold disease. If I'm an alcoholic with a twofold disease, I haven't had a physical craving or a mental obsession in over 20 years. I'm an alcoholic who's not only bodily and mentally ill, I'm spiritually sick, and I have a spiritual malady that was there before I ever took a drink. I'm involved in a three-part program for a three-part disease with 36 spiritual principles. I moved to California. I couldn't believe it. I'd never heard it in Colorado or anywhere else. But a lot of meetings in Los Angeles, in their format, it says the traditions are to the group what the steps are to the individual. My sponsor said there's as many principles in the 12 traditions for me as an individual as there are in the steps as there are in the concepts. Because who knew in this program is going to be interested in 12 traditions if they're just for the group? I'm selfish. I'm glad I got involved in the steps before I got involved in the traditions, but I'm glad there's spiritual power and spiritual principles in those traditions for me as an individual whenever I'm dealing with more than one person. Family, friends. Right? So I got out of the penitentiary when I was 21 with a firm resolution not to drink again. You get out and you go to your parole officer when you first get out, and they give you the conditions of your parole. You can't drink, you can't take drugs, you can't hang out with ex-felons, you can't go to bars, and you can't leave Calhoun County. That's like telling me, go home, take a deep breath, and never exhale. That's like telling, I mean, because that's what I do. I take drugs, I drink, I go to bars, I hang out with ex-felons, and you got to leave Calhoun County. You got to go to Detroit. You got to go to Chicago. So that was a death. That was a death sentence anyway. And for 28 days, boy, I was doing good. You know the one that used to scare me? Any of you relate to this? Your family's behind you again. Oh. Why did I hate hearing that? Because I know I'm going to break their heart. I used to hate hearing that. And the parole officer said, your family's behind you. We know you're going to make it. You're doing really good. And I was feeling good. And that's another delusion in Alcoholics Anonymous, that feeling good or not thinking about alcohol for many years got something to do with not drinking again. Not in my case. And I'm not special. And I'm not different. And I'm not unique. But I've had to search out the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are like me and ask them, what did you have to do? God, you can ask some people that say they're alcoholic in AA nowadays, and they'll tell you what they had to do. Just don't drink no matter what. Smash your ego and work on your character defects and bring about your own surrender. I stay away from those people as much as I can. Right? Because I can't do those things. If I could work on my defects, smash my ego, bring about my own surrender, my life wouldn't be unmanageable. And you got to figure in 22 years, I'd be a little more spiritual than I am now. Right? You'd be coming to an ashram in India to visit me rather than me coming to Baton Rouge, Louisiana to visit you. Right? My life's still on the line. I'm an alcoholic. I drink no matter what. Right? But the sad thing is, I always try to keep in mind the guy or the gal to direct to somebody who has been sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous for a period of time, and they're starting to feel out of place in the last place they got to go by a message that's been watered down to the point where the message of Alcoholics Anonymous ain't really popular in Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. I was told that's one of the signs of the end of the world. Right? The most famous rapper is white. The most famous golfer is black. The tallest guy in the NBA is from China. France accuses us of being arrogant. Germany doesn't want to go to war. And the message of Alcoholics Anonymous ain't popular in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? We're living in some strange times. Everything's upside down. But we don't have a problem with that. We know how to live when everything's upside down, right? And we got to be in it. But you don't have to be of it. We live in a recovered state. We have recovered. We have been given the power. Even that's not popular. Oh, he said he was recovered. What does he think he is? Cured? Next thing we'll know, he's drunk. No, I'm not cured. But I have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. First promise, first page, first forward, first edition. They promised me that, and I took him for granted. Right? Now, do I always live in a recovered state? Does the ego have huge recuperative powers? Am I an alcoholic that's had to do 1 through 9 over and over and over because I ain't got it right yet? Yes. But thank God for those people too. And there's the doctor that we need to listen to a little bit more, who gave everybody in this room, with any time at all, the most important piece of information that you need with time. It was important for all of us to look at the information from Dr. Silkworth, who gave us the truth about our bodies and what happens when we put alcohol in our body. That's important information when you get to AA like I was and you still have that question, like some of you still have tonight. And I'm not talking about just new people. I've had it at 7, 11, 15, 17. And that question was the same question I had before alcohol started working. What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? So it's good to know about the physical craving that takes place in my body when I put booze in it. And it's important that we take the information from Carl Jung of what happens in my mind that takes me back to the first drink, that will take me back to the first drink. You see, when I'm under the influence is not when I do crazy stuff. A lot of us in this room have done crazy stuff, but some of you stayed home and you're just as much alkie as I am. Never went to treatment. You never went to prison. That doesn't mean that I'm an alcoholic. You might be a real alcoholic and I might not even know yet. The alcoholic insanity, excuse me, for me, has to do with the most insane act of my life. That's picking up the first drink. I heard a guy in Australia who said it better than anybody I've ever heard. He said, I never took the first drink drunk. Boom. That's the insanity, and that's the piece that Carl Jung gave us. It's either true or it's not. If you don't get that obsession, don't worry about it. You could get the craving every time you drank, but if you don't get the obsession, just make up your mind never to drink again. You'll never get that allergy. You got to have both to be powerless. But then there was a doctor that was influential with our founders, and this debate goes all the way back to our founders. God bless Bill Wilson. We would not be here if it wasn't for Bill Wilson. Right? Bill Wilson suffered from depression for many, many years because he fell victim to a belief that 1 through 9 is meant to be done once, and you live the rest of your life in 10, 11, and 12. It didn't work for him. He stayed sober, helped all of us, started that office, helped thousands of people, and fell victim to a dry drunk syndrome that lasted 16 years almost. Hate to shock any newcomers, but he tried a lot of different things to get out of that depression. Dr. Bob, because of another man, another doctor that has a very important piece of information, Dr. Harry Thibault, who knew about the dry drunk syndrome, reconstruction of the ego. My great-grand sponsor, who's still alive in Chicago, Paul Martin, knew Dr. Harry Thibault, was brought in by Dr. Bob. And they believed in reworking and reworking and reworking the first 9 steps because of what the ego does. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, having had the major awakening that Bill had, a blinding flash, I didn't have it, woke up one night and wrote How It Works. I'm not discrediting that. I'm just saying this debate goes back to our founders. But I got to tell you, 1 through 9 once for me didn't work. It worked in that I stayed sober, but about a year and a half later, with unfinished amends, see, we always say, and I've actually heard from people that know that meetings don't keep them sober because they've had periods where they had to be at home or with a family member or in the hospital, and they'll say meetings don't keep them sober, but let Charlie go out, let so-and-so go out. First thing they say is, he quit going to meetings. No? But if you talk to him, he was living with some unfinished amends like you wouldn't believe, and maybe he was in a position in his group where he couldn't talk about it. He couldn't talk about it at 17 years. He couldn't talk about it at 11 years, that he was suffering because he'd put himself in a position. And thank God for those old boys that are willing to tell you the truth and risk your sensitive alcoholic feelings. And they care more whether you live or die than whether you might be uncomfortable with something they have to say. If I piss anybody off tonight, you go home, put my name in the first column, what I said in the second column, how it affected you. You'll see your part. Because I have to. I'm sure there'll be a couple I got to go home after the weekend. Right? You get to get free. How free do you want to be? So I don't know. I mean, I drank from 21 to 30 after the penitentiary. It didn't stop me. I've heard people say I couldn't drink because I was in jail. Not my experience. When you got to have a drink, you got to have a drink. I'm the guy in the penitentiary they thought was absolutely insane. Because when you make spud juice and it blows up once, you got to wait for it to go back down and blow up once again. You're not supposed to drink it when it blows up the first time because it can make you blind. I'd drink it. They'd say it'll make you blind. I'd say that's the purpose. I'm looking to get blind. I'm already blind. I don't care about, are you going to threaten me with blind? I'm already in the penitentiary. It'd be better to be blind in the penitentiary than being able to see. You don't want to see nothing in the penitentiary. Jeez. I get out. My parole officer tells me what will happen if I break my parole. They're going to send me back for 28 years. Behind the walls. Not a luxury camp. And I thought that was enough of a reason to keep me sober. Wouldn't you think so? Logical person, logical mind, overeducated. Walked out of his office 28 days later, having been reminded again. Had an idea I needed a pack of cigarettes, walked into a bar, picked up a drink, called an ex-felon, and drove out of Calhoun County. I'm a real alcoholic. And I was only 21 years old. I had 9 more years. I would love to tell the story about getting off parole, but that's too long. I got off parole. I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I got the dream that I came up with in the penitentiary. It was an unrealistic dream, but I got it by the grace of God. Please don't think the grace of God came into your life the day you came to AA. If the grace of God hadn't been in your life before you got to AA, this would be an empty room tonight. And my dream when I got out of the penitentiary was to deal blackjack in Las Vegas, Nevada in a casino. It's a little unrealistic since you can't do that with a felony. But I had a man who was like my father. When I was 17, he had 4 of us put one of these stars on our hands. He was 34, we were 17. All 4 of them are dead today. I'm the only one left, and that's one of the reasons I'm here tonight. That's one of the reasons I'm still willing. So I moved to Las Vegas. He gets me into dealer school. I worked downtown for 6 months. I got a job at the Dunes Hotel because of him. 6 months later, he died in my arms of a drug overdose of drugs that I paid for with my money. And I felt like I'd killed someone I loved more than my own father. And I had to live with that for many, many years. Part of me died, lost everything within 6 months. Moved to an unrealistic place with a realistic desire. And that was Key West, Florida. I'm not gay. I'm happy today. But I'm... I moved to Key West, Florida when it wasn't popular. I had long hair when people had short hair. I had short hair when people had long hair. I don't fit. And it was the last place I could go in the continental United States without a passport. And I gave up. I decided to die. And I'm a failure at that too. Had to trick myself to leave Key West because I had more knowledge than I did power. Nothing worse. Nothing worse than having been, and during the time I'd been a therapist. I'd been a therapist working in the field, drinking with the director of the program I worked for. I had to work in treatment twice sober to make amends for the harm I caused working in the field drunk. And I gave up, and I couldn't even pull off dying. And I had to trick myself to leave Key West by ripping off the right guy. And one day I ripped off the right guy and I had to go quickly. Because I tried to leave Key West, I'd get to a bar in Miami, spend my money, go back to Key West. And my game then was to call the family in Battle Creek and say, I'm coming home. And they'd say, no, you're not. Too many people after you. How much do you want? And I was basically paid to stay away. But I was bribing them. I was blackmailing them. Yeah. And that woman and I got to go free. My mother passed away 2 years ago last week, and we were free. Yeah. I never thought that could be repaired. Some of you have experienced a mother talking to you through a plate glass window on a telephone in a jail, and that look, and you think to yourself, that could never be healed. That could never be healed. And it was in this program. So I left Key West in a hurry because I ripped off the right guy. I might be stupid, but I might be alcoholic, but I'm not stupid. And I flew to Denver, Colorado to the last friend I had in the world. He said he was wanting to marry a girl and spend the rest of his life with her, and we couldn't party. And I didn't want to drink anymore. And 2 weeks later, she threw us both out. And he left me on a street corner, 30 years old, in Denver, Colorado. And I was more afraid than the day they put me in the Michigan State Penitentiary. And I don't know why. I wasn't doing anything illegal. Probably alcoholic paranoia. And I went from hotel to hotel to hotel along this street, East Colfax Avenue in Denver. And I don't know why I needed to move every 2 or 3 days, but my deal was to get a bottle of vodka and a room. And I went to treatment, and I stayed 2 days, and I had to have a drink. I had no choice in the matter. My drinking was beyond choice at that time. And for 8 weeks, I moved along that street. And I woke up one day, August 17th, 1982, in that hotel room, and I couldn't drink for the first time in 18 years. And I got to tell you, in my early sobriety, I never felt comfortable telling you that I quit drinking August 17th, 1982, because every time I quit, I drank again. And I liked the description Bill gave us. I was separated from alcohol for the last time, and it was a spiritual awakening that scared the hell out of me. I didn't know why. I couldn't imagine life not drinking. I thought the rest of my life would be drinking. I went back to that treatment center and they said, "We found out about you when you left. We were worried. If you're going to stay this time, you're going to have to be willing to do whatever we ask." And I was in that state that a lot of you were in or have gotten in when you were sober. You don't always hit bottom the day before you get here. Some of us take a long time to hit bottom in AA. And I said, "I'm willing to do whatever you ask." And they said, "You can't go to group because we know you've been a therapist. You'll either run it or turn it into a game. You can't talk to anybody during business hours from breakfast until dinner except your therapist. And he's a monk in a monastery downtown and a therapist during the day. And he knows everything about God and nothing about therapy. And you know everything about therapy and nothing about God. And we were perfect. Father Felix, he saved my life." Because I saw that everything I knew about therapy, chemical enzyme reaction, neurotransmitters, didn't do nothing to keep me sober. And he said, "Boy, you better pray that what you think you know be put aside for an open mind and a new experience." I heard Don Pritz in my first meeting while I was in detox. I saw the director of that program not too long ago, who's 45 years sober, and he said, and only in AA could you say this with any virtue, that I still held the record for detox from just alcohol, 15 days in detox. And I heard Don, and he scared me because I thought he'd changed himself. I knew he was like me, and I knew he felt like me when he was a kid, and he knew he had some of the same questions when he got here, like, "What's wrong with me?" But I thought he'd changed himself because I saw a man that was dramatically altered. And it took me 6 months to hit bottom with the second half of step one. See, I knew I was powerless over alcohol, but I thought the blank, the dash meant fill in the blank. And I filled in the blank. And my first step was, yeah, I'm powerless over alcohol, and that's why my life is unmanageable. So now that I'm not drinking, everything should be just hunky-dory. And it took me 6 months to get back to that place I vowed I would never go into because it was at the surface. That's when alcoholism hit me. Because when you're drinking, at least you got oblivion. At least you're going to pass out, even if it's not working anymore. But when you haven't had a drink for 5 or 6 months, or 5 or 6 years, or 17 months, or 11 months, it's going to come to the surface and it's going to piss you off. And they'd be having meetings on the promises, and I'd be like, "How do you get the promises on 93? And these old boys in Denver who love you more than they do how you might feel about what they have to say, they'd say, "You want to know how to get the promises on 93? Do everything from 1 to 92. It's really simple." I'd say things like, I'm afraid of my own mind." They'd say things like, "You have good reason to be." Right? I'd say, "I feel terribly inferior and insecure." And they'd say, "You want to know why you feel inferior and insecure?" And my eyes would light up and I'd say, "I've been looking for the answer to that in every place you can imagine all these years. Why do I feel inferior and insecure?" "Because you're inferior and insecure." Oh, pretty simple. I remember saying, I turned it over in the middle of one of these groups in Denver with these old scary guys. I turned it over and I took it back, and I turned it over and I took it back. And this old boy said, "Shut up and sit down, because if you're still doing that, you haven't turned it over. It's like a chicken and a pig." I'm not going to tell that whole story, but pigs make chickens make decisions to lay eggs, and pigs make commitments because we're talking about their life and ham and eggs, something like that, right? I don't know what they mean. It takes me a week to figure it out at home. And then one day I made a decision, and I went from a chicken to a pig, right? Because we were talking about my life. And at 6 months, I was dying of untreated alcoholism. I was ready to blow my head off. There's the stuff. You're having trouble with personal relationships. I didn't even know from personal relationships. I was having trouble talking to other people. Personal relationships. In Denver, they'd say, don't have a relationship for a year. Nobody knows if that works or not, because nobody in AA has ever made it a year without a relationship. Right? I told Bobby yesterday, if a relationship takes somebody out of this program, they ought to go to Sex Anonymous because they're in the wrong program, right? Boy, their slip would be my joy. Jesus. So, it took me 6 months to reach that bottom. I've seen people take 17, 20, 23 years in the grace of God. In the grace of God, believe it or not, if you're new here tonight and you're not drunk and you're a real alcoholic, you're already in the grace of God and there ain't nothing to find. It's already there. You got to find the closest thing to you, not the furthest thing away. God's closer than your next breath. If you're sober, you're in the grace of God. So why do the steps? Great question. I had a guy with 26 years ask me that. He said, I've been in the grace of God for 26 years. Why do I need to go through the steps again? What am I going to tell him? I was ready to blow my head off after 6 months. I said, you better, you know the old sponsor answer? When you don't know what to, better pray about it, right? He comes back 3 weeks later and he says, I know why I need to do the steps. Because I would like to have a conscious contact with that which has been giving me this grace for 26 years. And 2 years later, when he finished all his mends, he said to me, being in the grace of God and having a conscious contact is like night and day. So I went to Don when I was ready to die from sobriety. See? I realized sobriety is the number one state of consciousness that I hate more than any state of consciousness in my life. Untreated sobriety is something that was intolerable to me at age 12. Now I'm 31. I'm further away from my last drink than I've ever been. And if you think alcohol was the problem, wouldn't you think you'd be better if you were six times longer sober than you'd ever been? I'd never had 30 days in 18 years. No, in here it was worse. And that's really messed up when everything out here is better. And they're loving you. Just let us love you till you can love yourself. I knew guys that said, you need to quit loving yourself so much and start loving somebody else, right? I don't need any more love for myself. My God, right? I don't know. And I sat at Don's house, and he shared with me the circle and the triangle. Anyone in this room that knows Don and those of you that don't should probably be saying some prayers. Yeah, Don has a problem with his liver. And this is one of those times where I actually had times when I would speak that I thought you needed me. You know, kind of like when you're sponsoring guys and then you realize how much they helped you. This is one of those weekends where I came here knowing I need you more than you need to hear anything from me. My mother died 2 years ago this week. My best friend in AA that I've known since my first meeting died 5 days later. My economic value hasn't been as it should be. That's like when you're new and you walk into a room and they say you're the most important person in the room. And you go, my God, I've arrived. I'm finally somewhere where they realize my true worth, right? I like the old boys that said, the newcomer might be the lifeblood of AA, but thank God that blood's got a heart to flow through, or it would just be all over the floor. And the old timers are the blood, are the heart that blood flows through. Because without those men and women who are still here and who still care and who still carry the message, rather than being popular, they're the heart of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. Thank God for those people. Thank God Don Chris was in that treatment center in 1982, because I bet he'd rather have been home that night. I bet that treatment center wasn't somewhere he wanted to be that night, but he was there because he's alcoholic, not because they might or might not be alcoholic. And when I get into that in my mind, how can I go over there to carry the message? They might not even be alcoholics. I remember I'm going there because I'm an alcoholic. And he was there that night because he's an alcoholic. And I love that man with all my heart. I'd like to say he saved my life, but he didn't. But he pointed me to that which has. There's three kinds of sponsors, and I can say this, I have enough time now. I've seen three kinds of sponsors in these years. There's ones that will point you to them, because see, all we are fingers. We're just one of the fingers. Read the book, go to meetings, work the steps, get a sponsor. I thought they said those are the things that will keep you sober. Don said to me, no dummy, we just hoped all of them would get you in touch with something that's already keeping you sober. So we're fingers. But the funny thing is, you got to be careful what direction those fingers are pointing in. Some sponsors will point you to yourself. You can do it, just don't drink, work on it, they point you back to you. Some sponsors point you to them. Call me every day, I'm going to run your life, I'm going to keep you sober, I'm going to tell you what to do, I'm going to give you your defects, and this is how you're going to work on them. And some of them point you to something deep down within that they have found, and that's the direction Don pointed me in. Every good teacher I've ever had has said, look within, don't become dependent on me, but look for God, a God of your own understanding. And thank God the program of Alcoholics Anonymous says you're going to find that deep down within. That's a little scary at first because you know they mean that place you never wanted to go into again. But you know what? After a few months with Don and doing everything from the title page, I found out I wasn't in AA. Just because you're going to meetings, you're a member of the fellowship, there's only one requirement to be a member. Please don't think the only requirement for membership is the only requirement for sobriety. My greatest desire never worked, and he shared with me all three parts, all three legacies. I think a sad reflection today is when somebody has to say, I have a sponsor, but I needed someone else as a service sponsor. I think you should find sponsors that know about all three parts of the program, who have experience with unity, recovery, and service. And it's a sad reflection. It's a sad reflection on the commitment that those of us that have been around have given to service. Because we should be able to share a three-part program for a three-part disease with 36 spiritual principles that work in your life as an individual. Yeah. Some people say it's a selfish program. I think it's an absolutely selfless program for really selfish people like me. It's not a selfish program. But it's for selfish people like myself, thank God. Thank God there was somewhere left for me. Thank God there were some people that still wanted me here. Thank God there were some people that still welcomed me here. I was given the grace and the dignity to go to every amends I ever owed. Did I finish every one of them as far as paying everybody off? Did I finish the amends to my mother that went on the rest of her life and still goes on? But I was given the power to make every approach to every amends I was consciously aware of. I spent 2.5 years making 350 amends. And before I was done, I was absolutely amazed because the National Council on Alcoholism hired a guy like me to train kids to work with kids. And 1.5 years earlier, you wouldn't have let me near your children. I saw the insanity of working in the field because you can't tell the truth in the mental health field about a spiritual condition. But I then went to work in treatment. I learned my second lesson about the insanity and had more trouble with bureaucrats than I ever did with any client I ever talked to. And then my life took off and I moved to California. I was moved to California making an amends. And I got to be in California for 10 years. I got to watch about this many people come to a small group of 40 or 50 people to go through the steps and then go back to their communities. An effective group. We're not a popular group in Los Angeles. People have a lot of judgments about our group, but I'll tell you what, one of their friends or they get in trouble, you know where they send them to go through the work? I love that. I get some revenge on some old guys in L.A. when they send one of theirs. Yeah, because our group believes in all three parts of the program. Is the message popular? I think it is here. Is it our job to make that message popular by living it, doing it, and caring about it? Yes. Do I love Alcoholics Anonymous? Yes. Do I have concerns about Alcoholics Anonymous? Yes. And it's not easy to express those concerns sometimes when you think you want to be popular. But I don't care about being popular because I know who loves me. Right? And I got to tell you, I was a little concerned when the inside cover to our fourth edition says that page 1 through 164 is something that had been a foundation rather than is the AA message. That concerns me. I was a little concerned when the foreword of the fourth edition said that a meeting online in front of a computer screen is the same as looking in your eyes at my home group. And I think they are changing that. And I think we've always learned from our mistakes. And I'm not perfect. I'm not a saint. I have gotten everything back in AA and sobriety that I ever put out in my life. And it doesn't always feel good. But you know what? God's there when it doesn't feel good. That's the key. I brought a mind to Alcoholics Anonymous that says this. If I am uncomfortable, physically, mentally, emotionally, or spiritually, I have to do something to get out of the discomfort before I will find peace. That's not a realistic view of the future. We are all going to get older. We're all going to have suffering. We're all going to have loss. We're all going to have pain. I can get lost in joy just as much. The key is to find peace in the middle of the way things are. After 10 years in Los Angeles, through an amazing experience I'd love to be able to share, but there's not time, I was moved once again. I thought I was going on a three-month visit to northern India because I had met this incredible person. And I remember when I told my sponsor and my grand sponsor I was going to India, my grand sponsor from Indianapolis, Gary Brown, calls me, and Gary goes, "You got to be really careful with intuition. How do you know when you got the intuition to go to India, you weren't missing one letter, and it was, go to Indiana, go to Indiana, go to Indiana." I said, "Dear God, I hope it's not Indiana." But I was moved once again through a series of experiences I couldn't figure out with my mind. And I got to spend, I go for a few months, I'm alcoholic. I went for a few months, I stayed 5 years. And I got to be a part, and don't ask me how a guy like me gets to be a part of this. I got to be a part of starting a drug and alcohol treatment program for the Tibetan government in northern India for the first time in their history. They have access to our program. But God believes in rotation as much as speakers should. And it's sad, one of the biggest service positions in AA, because sometimes money gets involved, speakers don't rotate, and I think they should. And for 5 years, I didn't have the luxury of being with you people. And I didn't have the luxury of a home group. So I had to create the fellowship I crave, and I got to be a part of starting a three-part drug and alcohol treatment program. And as soon as you get good at it, you got to go. Everything in my life in AA in the last 22 years, as soon as you get a handle on it, God says, whoop, got to go. Next, because you need a chance, and you need a turn, and you need a turn. And we've got groups that have had the same secretary, GSR, DCM, or whatever it is, and they're celebrating 27-year anniversaries. And I think that's unfair to the new people in this room, to the new people in this room that need to hear from those people how to do that position and take that position and share with them all three parts of this program. You know, they tell you sometimes you'll never get what you want, but you'll always get what you need. I got to tell you, I was way past everything. I've had everything I've ever needed in 22 years. We passed everything I ever wanted about 15 years ago, and I'm way past even my own dreams because I'll sell myself short with my dreams. And I wish I had a great story to end this with, but I don't. So I'll tell you about the self-will. I'll tell you about my self-will. And it's like a bird growing up in Michigan. I like that because my last name is a bird name. And he's a bird growing up in Michigan, and he's going to do whatever he wants. And one winter, he ain't going south. He's going to stay. He ain't going with the crowd. He's going to stay in Michigan. And he starts to freeze. And just before he dives, he gets the idea maybe he better fly south. Gets up in the air, starts heading to Florida, freezes up in midair, does a nosedive into a cow pasture, and as he's dying, a beautiful little cow comes by and poops all over him. and it feels really warm, and it's thawing him out. And in joy, he lets out a song of joy. And just so happens a fox hears the song, comes in, comes over, pulls him out of the pile of poop, cleans him off, and eats him. And you know what the moral of the story is? Not everybody that poops on you is your enemy. Not everybody that pulls you out of a pile of poop is your friend. And if you're here tonight sitting in a warm pile of poop, keep your damn mouth shut.